Black Lives Matter members and others are marching in protest this evening in Philadelphia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Let's get the latest details about the protest from WHYY's Bobby Allen. And Bobby, what's this rally about?
Hey, Dave. So about 200 protesters from, like you said, Black Lives Matter and a few other social justice groups are clogging traffic across Philadelphia. They're now walking through Rittenhouse Square. They've been sort of zigzagging around Center City all night. And, you know, most of the ones I've interviewed have said they are very disenchanted with the two-party system. And this is most illustrated, they say, by the election of Donald Trump. They want a candidate that will take seriously the issues that they are pushing for, namely someone who will make some serious national statements about reforming stop and frisk, giving more support to public defenders, and reforming the bail system. I mean, these are three issues that they're really hammering on, and they say neither major party has grappled with them seriously enough.
Bobby, we're having some issues hearing you clearly. Briefly, what's happening now?
Right now, the group is moving through Rittenhouse Square, and there's, I would say, about 200 protesters chanting, holding signs, screaming in police officers' faces, and maybe 400 to 500 members of Philadelphia's law enforcement encircling the group. And they're cutting a very unpredictable path. They didn't reveal how they were going to move through the city beforehand, and we just went the wrong way up Chestnut not too long ago. It's kind of every time there is an intersection, they're taking a very spontaneous move, and that's really keeping law enforcement on their toes.
WHYY's Bobby Allen on the scene of an ongoing protest in Center City, Philadelphia this evening.
The students, united, will never be divided.
Students at several area colleges staged walkouts today, calling for their campuses to provide sanctuary to immigrants in the country without authorization. Under the hashtag Sanctuary Campus, Lehigh, Swarthmore, Haverford, Bryn Mawr, Penn, Temple, Rutgers, and Princeton join more than 100 schools in a national walkout. Organized by the COSECA movement, the walkouts are in protest of the potential deportation of immigrants proposed by President-elect Donald Trump during his campaign. Natasha Nogueta, a junior from Santa Cruz, California, spoke at the Swarthmore College event. As a child, she didn't know her Brazilian mother was not in the U.S. legally. She also didn't understand the despair her mother felt when pulled over by a police officer.
That same despair I felt again on Wednesday with the results of this election, knowing that my family could be separated, knowing that my mother is not necessarily safe in this country because of her status.
Nogueta says she knows students at Swarthmore and campuses across the country are feeling the same fear. Another concern addressed by the walkouts is Trump's possible ending of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Participants today pointed out that many so-called dreamers, those brought to the U.S. as children but without legal permission, have lived most of their lives in the United States. Dahlia Castro, a Swarthmore junior from El Paso, Texas, left her class at noon to join the walkout.
The area that I'm from, it's like right on the border, so I see a lot of people coming in and out of different countries, and so coming out to this event was very important to me because I want to see everyone enjoying sort of like an environment where there is no difficulty of being endangered because of the country that they are currently in.
Swarthmore College President Valerie Smith issued a statement today praising the students for speaking out for social justice and saying the school is investigating how providing sanctuary might work both legally and practically.
One, we are the students. Two, we are united. Three,
the Constitution says the government requires a warrant to seize property it thinks is illegal. There are exceptions, though, to that warrant requirement, and as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, one of those exceptions just got broader in New Jersey.
The so-called plain view doctrine means police can seize illegal property without a warrant if it's in plain view. That's what happened when cops pulled over Xiomara Gonzalez for traffic violations on the Garden State Parkway in 2009. The narcotics officer walking alongside her car spotted heroin spilling out of blue bags in the back seat. He arrested Gonzalez and seized the drugs. But part of the plain view exception in New Jersey required that law enforcement discover the illegal property by chance or inadvertently. It's called the inadvertence requirement. Had the cops known about the illegal stuff, the thinking went, they could have obtained a warrant. Frank Murawski is a deputy attorney general of New Jersey.
That requirement was removed from the Fourth Amendment back in the early 90s, and most states have removed that requirement. But in New Jersey, it was still a requirement, technically.
That is, until now. The state Supreme Court ruled that inadvertency was no longer needed as part of the plain view doctrine. In other words, if a cop spots illegal property in plain view, she can take it without a warrant. Opponents say the ruling leaves decisions that should be made by the courts up to police officers. Rebecca Livengood works for the New Jersey ACLU.
The warrant protection is the avenue the Constitution provides to ensure that police officers' intuitions are subject to a neutral review.
New Jersey is not alone in getting rid of the inadvertence requirement. The federal government and all but two or three states say cops can seize illegal property they come upon inadvertently or not. Civil rights attorney David Rudovsky says it's actually not a huge deal in most Fourth Amendment cases.
You don't see a lot of cases where the inadvertence requirement becomes a significant factor. In other words, it's not the most significant issue in the search and seizure area nationwide.
The ruling applies to all warrantless seizures in New Jersey in the future, but does not apply to past cases. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
This summer, 22 women detained with their children in a Pennsylvania immigration center went on a hunger strike. Some had been held for more than a year. Others complained of poor medical treatment. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that 1 year after a federal judge ruled that centers must release children after a few days, the practice continues amid protests and appeals.
If you were just to drive by the Berks Family Residential Center, you might not know what it is. It's a plain, four-story government building set back from the road by a wide lawn dotted with trees.
You know, it's kind of an unassuming brick building, you know, no barbed wire, no razor wire. But there are these little signs that say, no trespassing, secure facility, County of Berks. So that's really the only giveaway of what kind of an immigration center it is.
WHYY wasn't granted permission to go inside the building. The federal government says facilities like this one are an important precaution when processing the immigration claims of people who enter the country illegally. Critics counter that it amounts to imprisoning children, and who gets held is arbitrary. 14-year-old Allison Mendez-Leyba and her family have been held in the Berks Center for more than 13 months. She says the rigid schedule, which includes bed checks throughout the night, makes it feel like a prison.
They come every 15 minutes at night with a flashlight, lighting up the room. They say it's for our safety. They don't do it silently.
Family detention in the U.S. was exponentially expanded in 2014 in the face of a wave of families and unaccompanied children fleeing violence in Central America. At its peak, more than 3,000 beds across Texas and Pennsylvania were kept full. Last year, a federal court judge in California ordered the centers to stop detaining families for more than a few days, 3 weeks at most. Now, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, does release over 90% of detainees in less than a month. But some are still held much longer. Lawyer Peter Shea represents detainees in the federal case.
That still leaves hundreds of children and their mothers who are not released in that short time period and indeed may be detained for months on end, mostly at a facility at Berks.
He says those families tend to be children and their mothers who fail an initial asylum test at the border. At Berks, it also includes a group of women challenging their deportation orders on constitutional grounds.
The government's theory is that they are now subject to mandatory detention because they were not approved during this political asylum interview, the preliminary interview.
He's fighting that practice and has a hearing scheduled for January. Since 2014, more family detention means more kids are subject to the potential medical and mental health effects of long-term detention. Clinical social worker Kathy Miller has independently evaluated some of the long-time child residents at Berks, many of whom have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
They would get so desperate and
hopeless that they would express that they just wanted to kill themselves if they weren't released. And then they would wrap their lanyard around their neck.
Miller says there's a lot of research showing that restricting the movements of kids is bad for their mental health. It's linked to depression and stunted development. Records of psychological evaluations done by detention center staff and shared with WHYY show mental health staff often didn't talk to children during mental health checkups. For these and other reasons, this fall, 17 senators wrote a letter to the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, calling for an end to child detention. Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey was one of them.
They're at a facility that's meant to provide a bridge for them, but it's become almost like incarceration.
The Berks County commissioners, who own the center, and ICE defend the facilities as safe and necessary. Speaking on C-SPAN earlier this year, U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said the federal government has tried to make the centers more humane.
The practice has reformed considerably since 2 years ago when we first opened these things up.
It's piloting a trauma-informed care program at one of its Texas facilities and trying to make environments in the center less restrictive. In spite of these efforts, an advisory committee appointed by ICE recently recommended ending family detention as arbitrary, punitive, and unnecessary. The committee's report said it could find no policy regarding why some families with identical claims are released while others are detained. Still, Johnson says getting rid of the centers is just not on Homeland Security's agenda.
We need to continue the practice to process individuals as they cross the border illegally, to make certain assessments about health. We need to continue the practice so we're not just engaging in catch and release.
This year, the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services revoked the license for the Berks Center, but the government's fighting that decision. ICE has also attempted to license new centers in Texas. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Philadelphia's high taxes compared to those in nearby counties are often cited as a major reason for the flow of city residents and jobs to the suburbs. A Pew Trust study just out this afternoon points to a shrinking tax gap between Philadelphia and its suburbs. Let's get details with Pew Trust researcher Tom Ginsberg. Tom, welcome back to Newsworks tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
What are the major takeaways from this follow-up report?
Well, our analysis of the state and local tax burden in Philadelphia and the suburbs found that the tax disadvantage of living in the city instead of the suburbs has dropped now to its lowest point in 15 years, back to 2000 when we first looked at this. The city still has a high tax burden compared to the majority of the suburbs, but it has changed quite a bit over the last few years, and now the city is quite more affordable than it used to be in terms of taxes than a fair number of suburbs, particularly lower income suburbs.
Now, this applies exclusively, though, to homeowners.
This is all an analysis of a family of four that owns its own home, and it has an income, for this main analysis, has an income that's equal to the regional median income. In this case, for 2015, that was about $62,000 a year, and its house was worth about $180,000 a year. That's what this analyzes.
And so can we specifically then focus on changes in the property tax structure that led to this?
Oh, absolutely. So this takes into account the three major state and local taxes, the ones that most people pay, that is local property tax, state and local income taxes, and state and local sales tax. That's it.
Now let's look a little closer. I understand there is a disparity between rich and poor suburbs.
There is. So we sliced this data in a few different ways, and that's one of the things we did. We looked at to see how Philadelphia's tax burden on this middle-income family differs from the suburbs based on what their median household income was. Now, Philadelphia is a low-income city. It's well known. The median income was about 37 grand the year that we looked at. Philadelphia's tax burden improved the most against suburbs that also had low in median incomes. That is that Philadelphia's tax advantage grew over those towns, and not so much over the towns that were wealthier, had high household incomes.
So to what extent has that experience with taxes improved in Philadelphia over the course of this study? And you're saying, what, 15 years?
We looked at 3 points in time, year 2000, and then 2012, and then 2015. To put it in terms of dollars, that might be easier to understand. This hypothetical family that we created in 2000, it paid about $2,400 less in state and local taxes by living in the suburbs. In 2015, it paid only about $390 less in taxes. So the amount of savings it had in taxes really shrank quite a bit.
Now, how about when you factor in suburban dwellers who commute and then work in the city?
We looked at commuters too, particularly we look at in commuters, those coming from suburbs into Philly. We analyzed it for the New Jersey and the Pennsylvania suburbs. They, in our analysis, they actually fared the worst over this period. Their tax burden got much worse. And in fact, they went from saving only a few $100s back in 2000 to now spending an extra $1,200 on average.
Net loss.
Net loss. By living in the suburbs instead of living in the city and working in the city, or rather working and living in the suburbs, but not commuting.
So this is a specific follow-up to the 2012 study.
Correct.
Can we anticipate another study again a couple or a few years out?
We took about 4 years to do an update. A lot of things happened in that 4 years
in
terms of Philadelphia's taxes. In the interim, since our previous study, Philadelphia went through what's called the actual value initiative revaluation. That was a major impact. And in fact, as part of AVI, Philadelphia enacted a new homestead property tax deduction. That was part of the whole reform. As a result of that deduction, the Philadelphia family actually saw a continuing decline in its property tax burden and its total tax burden. So as a result, basically the trend that we're showing here for Philadelphia really was largely a result of the homestead tax deduction.
Derivative of that single piece of legislation.
That piece of legislation and that program enabled the family to see a continuing decline in its tax burden. Without that program, in using our model for the family that we used, its tax burden would have gone up instead of down.
We're meeting and greeting this hypothetical middle-income family. Did you also posit a low and or high-income family for the purpose of the study?
We did. We took this family, and in one scenario, we cut its income in half, down to $31,000 a year. And another scenario, we doubled it.
All homeowners.
All same family, but we just changed its income. And as a result, some of its tax obligations changed. Other taxes came into play. And what we saw was for the lower income family, actually for both, for the low and high income family, they saw the same trend through the 2000s. Its tax burden in Philadelphia declined. But since 2012, there was a change. The high income families' tax burdens started stabilizing. The lower income ones continued to go down, but the high income family did not see that benefit in the last few years. As part of our research, we've taken all of our data and we put it into an interactive map, and you can get that link through the newsworks.org site, and a reader would be able to see what the tax burden is in each town on this family and its gap with Philadelphia.
Tom, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Tom Ginsberg, Pew Trust researcher, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Finally this evening, around a year and a half after its launch, Philadelphia's bike share program Indigo has logged its 1 millionth ride. As the number approached on November 1st, Indigo began a contest, Philly to a Millie, promising to name an Indigo station after the millionth rider. Now that winning ride took place November 10th. Mantua resident Calvin Litton will have his name emblazoned on the bike share station at 39th and Mount Vernon Streets for 6 months. Though he's a genuinely devoted bicyclist, Mr. Lynn admits to gaming the system a bit, logging 21 rides in the 10 days of the contest. Indigo organizers and supporters will mark the milestone and officially name the 39th and Mount Vernon station after Mr. Linton for the next 6 months at a celebration planned for early December. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to support natural gas and coal industries, and tomorrow evening, we'll look at what the Trump presidency could mean for Pennsylvania's energy sector. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.